I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We begin our program with a study from the University of Adelaide, which is in Australia, as well as Southwestern University, or Southeastern University, which is in China. And it's about drinking dark teas and every day. And it can help mitigate type 2 diabetes risk and progression in adults through better blood sugar control. And that's important. This was shared at the annual meeting at the European Association for the Study of Diabetes in Hamburg, Germany. Now, there are many types of dark tea. I would suggest that if you're going to have a dark tea, have one that's decaffeinated, because you also can get a lot of caffeine, and that's not good for you. But this was an important study because it lowered the risk by 47% for type 2 diabetes, even after taking into account established risk factors to drive the risk of diabetes, including age, gender, ethnicity, body mass index, average arterial blood pressure, fasting, glucose levels, cholesterol, alcohol intake, smoking status. Take all that into account, and you drink a dark tea each day, and it can help prevent that progression. That's good news and inexpensive, but get it decaffeinated. Next up, this is about vitamin intake is linked with reduced premature death among diabetics. And this is from the Huizhong University of Science and Technology. A study reported in Diabetes Metabolism Research and Reviews uncovers a lower risk of death during a median follow-up period of 11 years among people with diabetes who consume sufficient vitamin A, folate, and niacin. Now, you're going to get folate and niacin from a B complex. And if you're having vegetables, especially your yellow, red vegetables, you're going to get vitamin A. A glass of carrot juice gives you vitamin A. They looked at 5,418 adults with diabetes who participated in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and they found that you could really reduce all the problems by just those three nutrients. And that's terrific. That's easy to do. B complex and some vitamin A. Recently, Fukushima in Japan released radioactive water back into the ocean. Not a good idea. Their thought is, well, the answer to pollution is dilution, meaning if you have a toxin and you put it into a large body of water, it dissipates over a period of time. That is true, but it doesn't become any less lethal to the sea life of all the fish, all the sea vegetables that are harvested, especially around Korea and South Korea, and also Japan and China. Mind you, when they're releasing that radioactive waste, hundreds of millions of gallons, back into the ocean, it will never in 2,000, 3,000 years become non-radioactive. So therefore, if you eat the fish, if you eat the seaweed, you're going to end up with high levels of radioactive material in your body, and that is not good. But here's what it also does. This is according to the Japanese National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. They looked at Fukushima and shows that even low doses of radiation can contribute to diabetes. Now, mind you, a lot of people went to the outskirts of Fukushima, but they didn't go far away. And many of them have come back because some of the soil samples that were taken by the government didn't show real high levels. But even in Tokyo, the largest city in the world, has about 39 to 40 million residents, they found everywhere in Tokyo, on the roof of buildings, in playgrounds, everywhere, when they sampled the dirt, it had excessively high levels of radiation after the Fukushima nuclear power plant exploded. Now, that doesn't go away, just like Chernobyl doesn't go away. Now, some animals can adapt to that, but humans can't. We do not have the genetic predisposition to suddenly make ourselves immune from radiation. So, those who live near Fukushima, even low doses of radiation contributes to diabetes. And of course, this was presented at the annual meeting of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes in Hamburg. And they looked at 20,000 emergency workers who responded to the radiation accident at Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Plant, which was hit by a massive tsunami back, if you remember, in March of 2011. And what they found was, even with all their hazmat suits on, radiation protecting boots and gloves and everything else, it had a devastating impact. So that's not good, you know, and they ended up with high levels of diabetes. So just one more thing lets us know why we should be moving off nuclear. From the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, yoga improves arthritis symptoms and mood. A randomized trial of people with two common forms of arthritis has found that yoga can be safe and effective for people with arthritis. Johns Hopkins researchers report that 8 weeks of yoga classes improve the physical and mental well-being of people with two common forms of arthritis, knee osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. The study is believed to be the largest randomized trial so far to examine the effects of yoga on physical, psychological health and quality of life among people with arthritis. So that's important. And by the way, you improve your breathing, your body becomes more flexible. Most people, when they get up in the morning, they're stiff and they don't really stretch. This helps stretch out all those muscles, lower back muscles, neck muscles. So it's good. Also, you increase your upper body strength when you're doing yoga. And finally, from the University of Copenhagen, researchers have found what they believe is a cause of Parkinson's disease. Well, I can tell you a lot of causes from the scientific literature: pesticide exposure, high levels of chronic stress 24/7, nutrient deficiencies, especially the B complex and vitamin C, being around electromagnetic pulsing machines, all right? But there are more than that. Well, until recently, most of orthodox understanding of Parkinson's disease has been quite limited, which has been apparent to the limited treatment options and management of this debilitating condition. Well, I've worked with a lot of people with multiple sclerosis, and they've had major improvements. But our recent understanding has primarily revolved around the genetic factors responsible for family cases, while the causative factors in the vast majority of patients remain unknown. However, a new study, researchers from the University of Copenhagen have unveiled new insights into the workings of the brain in Parkinson's patients. Leading the groundbreaking discovery was a professor, Navikas. And this professor said that the mitochondria, mito, M-I-T-O, chondria, C-H-O-N-D-R-I-A, that's the energy factory producers, within the brain cells, particularly neurons, undergo damage, leading to disruptions in mitochondrial DNA. The initiates and of this spread the disease like a wildfire through the brain. Okay. So we know then that damage to the mitochondrial DNA. So why not simply go towards turning off all pro-inflammatory causes like alcohol, like fried food, deep fried food? They cause inflammation in the brain. Just suggesting. In any case, that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who, someone wrote me a letter recently. My office said, Gary, we have someone who's asking about higher doses of resveratrol intake. Does it help with a person with dementia? One form of dementia is Alzheimer's. According to the latest study, just out this week, from Georgetown University, long-term intake of high-dose resveratrol can help people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease to stabilize a biomarker that declines when the disease progresses. That's good news. Now, granted, it's a small-scale study, but it's all positive. So yeah, 100, 200, 300 milligrams a day of resveratrol was good. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we have one of the world's leading economists, Professor Michael Hudson. because we have had so many individuals ask about what's happening as far as the digital currency taking the place of dollars. Where does America stand with all of its debt as far as the sovereignty of the dollar as an investment vehicle, etc.? So everything I can ask him within 55 minutes, I'll be asking him concerning finances. That's at 7 o'clock on PRN.live. Also, a lot of people will listen by a computer or maybe over the telephone. But if you're out and about, there's a number you can call and you can listen to this program. Let me give it to you. Please write it down. If you want to listen live, noon to 1, Monday to Friday, call 605-562-5119. 605-562-5119. But if you miss that and you want to call, listen to an archive show, that number is 631-359-9463. 631-359-9463. And now to a special original in-depth investigation. Just a little background before I get to the substance of this discussion. More than 2.5 years of research has gone into this. I've personally put over 2,000 hours. I'm Rich Gale, probably put over 1,000 hours in order to go back and look at all the facts. And we've written several articles on ivermectin and why the media didn't pay attention to it, because it was all there in the peer-reviewed literature. Yet they said, well, it's just a bad idea. It's not only not a bad idea, it's a very good idea. I also want to thank Katie, our research editor, who went back through and examined every single footnote. We're talking about over 3,500 articles. That's a lot of articles. And now we have, and I'll post this later today, what I consider an important piece. Now, why should you consider this important? Because of two candidates running for office. Actually, three. Cornel West, lesser so, in that he's not, doesn't have a background in science or litigation, but Robert Kennedy Jr., and now it looks like, again, I can be wrong, that it'll be a challenge between Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Gavin Newsom. For the main Democratic ticket. I see no way in the world that Biden will be on that ticket. But who you vote for is your business. But one thing is important. If Kennedy can cut 20 to 25% of the votes out of the Democratic Party by getting in younger idealistic people and older people who wouldn't vote because of corruption of the Democratic Party, who are independents but still Democrat and liberal, then he has a chance. But he's already told us he will challenge to get us out of the World Health Organization, challenge the UN, challenge the defense budgets, close down all these bases around the world. There's no candidate that I can recall, except for Ralph Nader, who would do as much to change the power structures away from big pharma and big ag and big banking, and bring it back to the States. And he has the experience to do that. And let's hope that he uses the information in this article, because if you know any attorney, especially attorney who is good at personal injury, this will provide them with an abundance, a surplus of qualified documentation. This is not opinion. This is fully documented. Now to the article. Did Anthony Fauci, the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, cause the deaths of 3.4 million people? Let me repeat that number, 3.4 million, and that's a low estimate. What do we do when our agencies, our institutions, and the very machinery of democratic government have been commandeered by profit interest and weaponized against the people? Do you think it's time that we call for a new Nuremberg? Over the past 3 years, the FDA, the CDC, the National Institute of Health, and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the AMA, U.S. Public Health Service, and a group of over 3,900 American, local, and legacy media partners engaged in what I believe is a conspiracy of misinformation and misdirection, which led to the preventable deaths of at least 3.4 million people globally, and the preventable injuries and the hospitalizations of millions or billions more. It opened the gate for the administration of over 13.5 billion doses of the world's deadliest product ever marketed as a vaccine. This conspiracy of misinformation centered in part around the intentional suppression of ivermectin, a conscious disinformation campaign spearheaded by the FDA, conflated human formulations of ivermectin with the animal formulations. One of the tweets from the FDA's communications team, quote, successful, quote, new engagement strategy reads, quote, you're not a horse. You're not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it, end quote. This so-called strategy was widely cited in newspapers, magazines, digital media outlets, and medical and professional advisories. Additionally, federal and state courts began citing the post in cases involving ivermectin, and they were referenced in legal complaints and judicial opinions across the United States. This campaign was conducted with the apparent malice aforethought. These acts culminated in what can only be called medical genocide. Never in recent history has a fraud of such magnitude and lethality been carried out. Doctors Brian Tyson and Dr. George Farid of the United States treated 20,000 patients with ivermectin. What was their outcome? 99.9% improvement, and not one of them ended up going to the hospital nor dying. Dr. Shankara Chetty of South Africa reported treating 8,000 patients with zero death and 100% improvement. Dr. Jeffrey Davis of the United States reported treating 6,000 patients with 100% improvement and zero death. Dr. Barry Marble of the United States reported treating 150,000 people with zero death and 99.9% improvement. Now, a case series of 39 physicians and their teams from around the world, all of whom use ivermectin as part of an early treatment protocol, including those physicians just mentioned, were found to have a mean improvement of over 94%, treating a total of 237,521 patients. Let me repeat that. 94% improvement with 237,521 people. So you would think, reasonably so, that, wow, if someone were treating any disease, heart disease, cancer, dementia, diabetes, and had a 94% success rate in improvements and nearly 100% success in non-deaths, we would make that headline news. Every major scientific body, from the Scripps Institute to the CDC, would be funding studies to see if it could be replicated. And if it could, then these would indeed be considered just remarkable improvements. Lives saved, disease and disease prevention engaged, so that you prevent a person from getting sick, spreading the disease, going to hospital, getting intubated, taking remdesivir, the drug that was authorized by Anthony Fauci, and dying. But it wasn't. Have you seen 60 Minutes, 2020, Nightline, Dateline, PBS NewsHour, NPR? Any credible and respected media source anywhere in the United States, tell you the figures I just did. Interview any of the doctors. Let me tell you, I'd interview the doctor that had over 120,000, 150,000 patients, and none of them died. Why did we know this? Dr. Mary Talley Bowdwin treated more than 3,900 patients for COVID-19 with a success rate of over 99.97%. None of the people she treated early required hospitalization, where she and these other successful doctors celebrated. No, they were condemned. This is the first time in American history that I'm aware of that vast numbers of physicians and scientists and physician scientists, MD, PhDs, were able to successfully treat patients where everyone else was failing. Their patients were dying, and their patients were surviving, and yet to a person, every one of these people were condemned. How's that possible? And yet when you talk with the doctors, when you look, no one from the CDC, no one from Anthony Fauci's office, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, no one from the FDA, no one from the New York Times, no one from the Washington Post, gave them a call and said, is it true that you've treated these patients with no deaths? What does that tell you? It should tell you a great deal. There's a website called C19 Early colon or .org. It displays the totality of the evidence on the safety and efficacy of different early treatments, presenting real-time analysis of 3,335 studies. We went through every single one. Of 56 early COVID treatments from the database of 5,674 treatments. So of all the different treatments around the world in different countries, they either had some success, no success, or a great deal of success. These were all put into a database. According to this website, ivermectin has been studied in 222 studies for COVID-19, 172 of which were peer-reviewed, and 99 of which compared the treatment to a control group. These 99 studies were conducted by a total of 1,089 scientists involving 137,255 patients in 28 countries. Ivermectin was found to be associated with statistically significant lower risks of death, ventilation, ICU, hospitalization. Overall studies of early treatment with ivermectin show a 62% reduction of risk. Early treatment with ivermectin resulted in a 49% reduction in death. Now, mind you, I saw some studies where they had a 90% reduction in death, a 95% reduction in infection accruing to the point where you had to be hospitalized. But they're taking a mean average here. I wouldn't do that. I would go through all those studies, and I would select the best controlled studies, the best foundational study with those results. And that would give even a higher success rate. So no matter how you cut it, even using the most conservative statistics, you have a treatment that far outweighs any treatment any doctor, any scientist in the government has offered. But instead of recommending ivermectin, and by the way, this is just by itself, and none of the doctors I've spoken with, many, and nurses gave ivermectin by itself. They would give it with hydroxychloroquine, but we're not here today to talk about hydroxychloroquine. We're vitamin C, vitamin D3, zinc, quercetin, azithromycin, the antibiotic. No, they used about 22 different medications and nutrients, and that was their overall success. The very highest numbers of preventing getting over COVID in hours or a day, not going to the hospital, not dying, came with a combination. I'm only referring to ivermectin by itself. And yet I don't know anyone using it by itself. Certainly no one who understands how it works. But instead of recommending ivermectin, the health establishment vilified it, calling it horse dewormer. Instead, Dr. Anthony Fauci said that Gilead's drug remdesivir would become the standard of care. And what he said is America's scientists, and you can't criticize him because then you're criticizing, according to him, all of science. Everyone fell into line. Every hospital, every treatment, they were giving people remdesivir. According to the remdesivir research literature, and we have it all. Every single study ever done on remdesivir, 58 published studies conducted on 946 scientists involving 155,923 patients in 20 countries. Overall, the studies of remdesivir show a 10% improvement. That's it. But clearly, remdesivir is not in the same league with ivermectin. But there's nothing about ivermectin. It's the, one of the most minimally toxic drugs. Can't say the same thing for remdesivir. But if it's more than just a question of efficacy, ivermectin has a very high safety profile. Remdesivir, on the other hand, is consistently found to result in acute kidney failure. It also appears to be dangerous if taken as a late treatment, evidence of which is presented in my footnotes. None of the studies of ivermectin display risk comparable to those of remdesivir. Dr. Sidney Wolfe of the public advocacy group Public Citizen wrote a letter to the FDA in April 2021 accusing them of improperly expediting approval for remdesivir, bypassing review of its public advocacy and advisory committee. But the FDA, the CDC, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the National Institute of Health and Healthy Human Services and their hired media partners insisted that ivermectin was dangerous and might kill you. Well, if you're the average person and you hear someone on television that you respect and you think, well, they have all kinds of resources, producers and fact checkers, clearly they wouldn't be saying something that wasn't bound by a lot of good data, not just cherry picked. You then would be wrong. And in this case, you could be deadly wrong. Because the people you trust, and therefore you're making a choice of your body, what goes into it, they don't seem to have had any problems at all of you putting one of the most toxic drugs you could possibly put into your body, especially for your kidneys. When the kidney goes, guess what happens? The lungs are filled with fluid. So then is intubation by pulmonologists the correct therapy? Not when you realize that up to 75% of all the people that got intubation therapy died. So where are we at now? Well, where we're at now is that they loudly broadcast the so-called new scientific news that FDA CDC partnered in with the what is called the poison centers across America, and they were filling elevated numbers of quote exposures to ivermectin instantly at exactly the same time that prescriptions for ivermectin were noted anxiously by the CDC to be rising dramatically. Okay. As the exposure is not a poisoning, but they didn't tell you that. A phone call without reported details does not itself mean that it's a toxic case. The caller may have simply taken ivermectin along with five other medicines or given animal ivermectin to his or her dog and got some of on their fingers, and if a person was hospitalized after taking ivermectin, that does mean that it was the ivermectin that caused the situation for the hospitalization. Didn't matter. Everything you could say against ivermectin was said, and there was not allowed a single voice in response. Now, mind you, we're talking about an awful lot of physicians, regular pro-vaccine, pro-COVID protocols, orthodox doctors and scientists, who had never had a controversial moment probably in their career. And now they were being attacked, but not interviewed. As far as we can determine, the basis of their propaganda against ivermectin was based upon a statistical hoax. In fact, we could not find evidence of a single poisoning attributable to ivermectin reported by an uncompromised, unbiased source in preparing this information for you. On the other hand, Tylenol is responsible for 56,000 emergency department visits, 2,600 hospitalizations, and 500 deaths per year in the United States. Did you hear Anthony Fauci or anyone in the media telling you don't take Tylenol? You could be one of those 56,000 people going to an emergency room, one of those 500 people dying. No. But we couldn't find one. And so therefore it was a charade. Three doctors who prescribed ivermectin brought suit against the FDA and the Health and Human Services and three health officials for their, quote, horse dewormer campaign, detailing the toll it took on their reputations and careers, such as suspensions and loss of hospital privileges. A new ruling has recently been presented on the case. The judges ruled that the FDA's anti-ivermectin messaging stepped over the line into the realm of practicing medicine, which is a health agency's ground that they can't go into. No, you can't do that. Its campaign against ivermectin to treat COVID-19 was not protected by its sovereign immunity, which shields it from being sued while carrying out its duties. Something for the lawyers in this audience to remember. And we have all the documentation. I believe, I haven't counted them, but I believe we have over 100 pages of footnotes and endnotes alone, and all the charts supporting everything. Immaculate documentation was done. So what are we presenting here? We're trying to lay out the evidence, not our opinion, that by waging an illegal propaganda war against ivermectin, the FDA, the CDC, Anthony Fauci specifically, Health and Human Services, Collins, and their partners were directly responsible for the wrongful deaths of 3.4 million people globally and the wrongful injuries and hospitalizations of millions, possibly even billions more. If ivermectin had not been effectively blacklisted, its use in early treatment could have saved millions of lives. Therefore, we are presenting the peer-reviewed and only the peer-reviewed scientific studies from the National Library of Medicine that show that ivermectin is a safe and effective drug therapy and could have reduced illness by up to 62% minimally and mortality minimal 49%. But in many studies, much higher in clinical practice, 100%. We also present evidence that the protocols authorized for emergency use, including kidney toxic drug, remdesivir, were deadly and never should have been considered safe or effective, as it is clearly shown by the actual science. And I have examples of this. Now, mind you, I'm only giving you some examples. Far more examples are in the separate attachment that you will see to the article. And again, it's not something you just casually read. This is based upon, if you're going to sue someone, you want to have an awful lot of documentation and case law to use. Here are some examples of ivermectin's efficacy from studies of statistically significant outcomes. You have Qatar et al. That means a bunch of scientists found that ivermectin was significantly associated with 90% lower death rate, 72% lower ICU admission, and 80% higher hospital discharge. Theru et al. Found that ivermectin was significantly associated with 55% higher hospital discharge, meaning you're going to get out of the hospital quicker if they use ivermectin. Kerr et al. Found that treatment with ivermectin was significantly associated with 92% lower death rate. In another study, the same authors found that treatment with ivermectin in hospitals was significantly associated with 45% lower death rate, even when you'd gotten to the point of going into the hospital. In a third study, Kerr et al. Found that treatment with ivermectin was associated with 70% lower death rate, 67% lower hospitalizations, and 44% lower cases, fewer cases. Asensio et al. Found that treatment with ivermectin was significantly associated with 59% lower death rate and hospitalizations. Simsuzu and et al. Found that ivermectin was significantly associated with 100% lower death. I repeat, 100% lower death, 48% lower ventilation, 43% lower ICU admission, 38% less ICU time once admitted, and 78% less GI complications when ventilated. Zine et al. Found that people treated with ivermectin had significantly lower death rate, 61%. Mayer et al. Found that people treated with ivermectin had 55% lower death rate. Semajar et al. Found that people treated with ivermectin had significantly lower cases, 80%. Now, this is remdesivir. Here are a few examples. I'm only showing you a few of the peer-reviewed literature of the dangers of the drug that Anthony Fauci and the hospital administrators and the ICU, that I consider them all equally culpable. You should have done your homework, people. So when you get yourself sued, just remember, you put everything ahead of the patient, because the first thing you should have done is gone to the peer-reviewed scientific literature, which we have, which you will see, and you could have found what I'm about to read you. Quote, Mishawashimi et al., in a retrospective analysis of 18,566 people hospitalized in Japan, found 44% higher rate of death. I repeat, 44% higher rate of death with late treatment using remdesivir. Leo et al. Found that late treatment with remdesivir was associated with 416% higher disease progression. Bowen et al. Found that late treatment with remdesivir was significantly associated with 57% higher death. Al-Shamirvani et al. Found that people treated late with remdesivir experienced 43% longer ICU admissions. Arch et al. Found that the late treatment with remdesivir was associated with 68% higher ventilation. And also, OI et al. Found that those treated late with remdesivir had 100% longer hospital stays. Schmidt et al. Found that late treatment with remdesivir was associated with 509% higher incidence of severe cases. Kernick-Yongo et al. Found that late treatment with remdesivir was associated with 460% higher death rate. I repeat, 460% higher death rate. Kim et al. Found that late treatment with remdesivir was associated with 1,612% higher risk of death. So the question is, if I can find this information and present it to you from peer-reviewed literature, from qualified studies, why would Anthony Fauci and all the hospital administrators agree by consensus, let's use this, instead of what prevents death, what causes death? Thousands of media organizations parroted health agencies' claims that the officially prescribed COVID medical interventions are safe and effective, and that ivermectin and other safe early treatments are unsafe and ineffective. The truth is just the opposite. Any of these journalists and editors could have found what we found if they had spent the thousands of hours, but they could have done this in about 2 hours. But we read every study. Big difference. But they did not do that, not in a single incident. Instead, they took orders from someone, somewhere, beyond their pay scale. And then they fell into lockstep with a tyrannical and catastrophic breakaway government with clear malice aforethought. And by abandoning the duties of their professions, they engaged in what I believe is a conspiracy against the American people, each contributing in his own way to millions of unnecessary deaths and injuries. Now let's take a moment to look at this intubation. Because we were told that's what will save you. Well, not true. The kidney toxic remdesivir was used alongside protocols for unnecessary and lethal intubation. Most people were intubated, died. One study recorded 76% of people died after intubation. Did they look at hyperbaric oxygen therapy instead? Totally different process. No. Remdesivir was also used on people who were ill and weakened from dutifully following the fraudulent preventative measures prompted as fervently as ivermectin was vilified. All of these have now been debunked. They include masks, social distancing, the quarantining of healthy people, and lockdowns. Ivermectin was suppressed. most importantly and most fatally, in order to clear the way for the emergency use authorization, the EUA, of the modified RNA gene therapy injections. Don't call it a vaccine. Call it accurately. It is not a vaccine. It is a modified RNA gene therapy. These so-called vaccines are a novel technology bearing no resemblance to the traditional vaccines. These modified RNA injections were responsible for the injuries and deaths of millions of people. According to former BlackRock portfolio manager Edward Dowd and his team of PhDs and data scientists analyzing disability, actuarial, and other official data sources, as of March 2023, the COVID vaccine was responsible for 300,000 excess deaths, 26.6 million injuries, and 1,360,000 permanent disabilities. He also believes that they are the cause of 84% increase in deaths among millennials in the United States in the third quarter of 2021. Although when you look at all the different figures on deaths, you come up with different amounts. So we try to go conservative, go lower. Altogether, nearly 7 million people worldwide are estimated to have died from COVID-19. These figures are promoted forcefully and ad nauseum by the legacy media and health agencies in order to justify the narrative that COVID-19 was a health crisis of unprecedented proportions. This narrative has been and is still being used to terrorize people, distract them, and to immobilize them from rebelling at all costs and defending the few remaining threads of democratic government, civil society, and the protections afforded by our constitutional rights. Deceived by this false narrative, people became paralyzed with fear. Then they meekly stood by while the medical-industrial complex, in coordination with captured governmental agencies and legislators, and virtually all the media, including some of the alternative media, further eroded and dismantled our few remaining societal protections and democratic institutions and ushered in a new totalitarian paradigm of biomedical fascism and tyranny, far suppressing that which exists before. These 7 million of deaths attributed to COVID must be carefully scrutinized. They have been estimated by a variety of altogether deceitful means. They cannot be trusted in any way. Most recently, they were determined based upon a fraudulent test, the PCR test, which is not an accurate diagnostic test to tell you if you have a disease and what stage the disease is with the appropriate treatment. No, it's merely an amplification technique. Important, yes, but designed to replicate bits of genetic material present in the system. It cannot tell you if you are going to die, if you're deadly sick, or if it's the primary cause of a disease. And it's amplified. But with this caveat accounted for, supposing we take these official numbers of COVID deaths at face value, supposing there really were 7 million deaths from COVID, ivermectin reduces risk of the most serious outcomes by 62%. It reduces mortality by 49%. That's 4,340,000 cases. The most serious outcomes could have been averted through the early use of ivermectin alone. 3,430,000 lives could have been saved. It is important to bear in mind that these are not completely accurate statistics because there are too many different sources, and some sources have simply been completely fraudulently obtained, including the VERA system, the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System, which is just shameful in how bad they were of not recording pressure in hospitals. We interviewed the nurses. We interviewed the doctors. They were told, don't put the cause of death as the vaccines. Have you seen a single special in any media where victims young people, totally healthy, fit as can be, dropped dead of a heart attack or had a heart attack and survived. You have not. Was that not important? Evidently not to the legacy media. How did the health authorities and the media vilify this drug? Ivermectin has a long record of safety and use. It won the Nobel Prize and was on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. It has been prescribed safely in humans ever since it was first marketed by Merck in 1988. How did the health establishment convince people that this drug wasn't the relatively safe and effective drug it has always previously been considered to be? They engaged in a deliberate conspiracy, in my opinion, through false propaganda and a marketing technique known as information flooding. They spread a false narrative that ivermectin was horse dewormer and dangerous for humans to take. I would like to see all of the people who advocated not to take ivermectin and to get vaccinated, I would like to see all of them justify their position today or to apologize. That will not happen. They flooded the media with spurious articles promoting misleading and conspiratorial statistics, contradictory statistics, designed to make it appear that many people were going to the hospital from ivermectin poisoning, when in fact, no evidence of even one poisoning, let alone one hospitalization or death, was presented by an unbiased source. Then they made it almost impossible for doctors to prescribe ivermectin to their parties by calling for a pharmacy ban on the drug. Doctors and pharmacists were intimidated by the lobby organizations for the medical industrial complex, the American Medical Association, the state medical boards, the American Pharmacy Association, and the American Society for Health Systems Pharmacists, into acquiescing to their demands. The AMA collects data on and maintains a full prescription history of every doctor in the United States and would know when he or she prescribes ivermectin. Board certification organizations were threatening to revoke the licenses or the board certifications or suspending them if they suggested this, and yet some did. Merrill Nass, Pierre Corey, Paul Merrick. This was to serve as an example. Take out the best and brightest, take out the most courageous, destroy them. And then you create a heretical notion. These doctors are heretics. They deserve what they got. Really? They were saving lives. Well, that's not important, evidently, in the current analysis. This is not an isolated event in history. It has been concluded and no longer poses a threat. No. Though the COVID-19 pandemic has been officially called to an end, the new architecture of public health and medical tyranny is ongoing and advancing at the global level. And so the idea is, where do we stand? How do we stop this? Here's what we can prove. There was no legitimate reason for the FDA to fast track any of the experimental vaccines under the emergency use authorization policy. Because according to the FDA's own literature, as long as there is an FDA-approved drug in existence that can be used for a given disease, then you cannot have another drug or vaccine given the emergency use authorization. However, the commercial value of marketing ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or monoclonal antibodies or azithromycin or vitamin C, D3, zinc, and quercetin, all of which are supportive when used in combination in stopping the spread of COVID from infection to illness and death. However, these remedies are not profitable to individuals, to hospitals, to industries. Never before, as far as I'm aware, has there been such an effort by the entire machinery of federal government gone to such extreme lengths to attack, vilify, and destroy a drug that has been given in billions of doses safely as an antiparasitic medication in Africa and South America, around the world, in humans for decades, and then attack and vilify it and cancel the reputations of mainstream, highly respected physicians and scientists for using a drug successfully on their patients. Ivermectin and these other therapies are supported by volumes in the peer-reviewed literature. But the motive for destroying ivermectin and other therapies was that it was not profitable and they didn't have control of it. This means that what they did with malice and, in the, my opinion, unmitigated greed. But in conclusion, at this time, these officials made these choices. There was no counterbalancing voices in the media or government agencies saying, hold on a second, stop. This makes no sense. We're talking about medicine clinics and physicians that could use this drug to save hundreds of thousands of lives. We should pay attention to this and do clinical trials on this. No. As a result, the man who said that he represented science, Anthony Fauci, thwarted every effort to fund a clinical study using ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, monoclonal antibodies, vitamin C, D, zinc, and quercetin. But others, over the next 2 years, did do studies showing how each of these individually had a statistically significant, even remarkable result of saving lives. That means that with all of the outstanding resources, the very capable intellectual and skilled journalists that we have in America in the mainstream media could have found this information just as easily as we did. Therefore, in my opinion, I must consider the culpability of the entire media and the entire Washington health establishment is responsible for millions of preventable deaths and tens of millions of preventable hospitalizations, injuries, and other suffering. All of our footnotes, by the way, and the expanded analysis offered in the technical supplement will be at the end of this, and you can download this. That is a special report. We're coming up to the end of our time on WBAI, so we'll say goodbye to them so they can go to the news, and we will continue. If you'd like to call in now and share your thoughts, now's the time to do it. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. This will be labeled under later today, probably in about 2 hours, on GaryNoll.com under articles under COVID. And it joins a lot of other articles. Hopefully, now, you have been injured or a relative injured in a hospital using remdesivir, or you were told not to use or couldn't find or couldn't get these other non-toxic therapies, this should be the basis of a lot of class action lawsuits. Now, I promised yesterday that I would give you some information, and I'm just going to ask our staff in New York in the studio, if anyone calls in, please just let me know over my headset, because I want to read some stuff here. In my entire life of flying, and I've flown all over the world, I've flown millions and millions of miles, I never heard of a pilot or co-pilot having a heart attack or dying while flying. How many people do you think, pilots, became incapacitated or died just in the last 4 weeks? This is startling. September 24, 2023, Australian Airlines flight 186 to Stuttgart. The captain became incapacitated. First officer to control the aircraft. September 23rd, Alaska Airlines. 37-year-old Captain Eric McRae died suddenly in his hotel room layover when he was going to start flying that morning. August 27th, Air Canada flight AC-348, Vancouver to Ottawa. One of the pilots fell ill, became incapacitated. 5 minutes later, they landed. He was taken to the hospital. August 16th, Qatar Airways flight 579, 51-year-old pilot collapsed as a passenger in flight and died. Plane diverted to Dubai. August 14th, 2023, a flight Miami to Santiago, Chile, 2 hours into the flight, 56-year-old captain collapsed and died in the laboratory. Plane diverted to Panama City. August 9th, United Airlines, flight 1309, Sarasota to Newark. Pilot had a heart attack and lost consciousness in flight. August 7th, 2023, Tiger Air flight 237, Sapporo to Taipei. Co-pilot had a medical emergency after landing plane. But then let's just go back a little further. Go right back. I won't give the dates, but it'll take a little time. I just want to wrap this up. We had Frankfurt, pilot incapacitated, first officer to control. Toronto, first officer became incapacitated. Deadheading captain assumed duties. Tennessee to Long Island. Fighter jet spotted pilot slumped over in cockpit, unconscious. Plane crashed and all on board died. Dublin, 20 minutes after liftoff, pilot became unable to act. Plane diverted to Manchester. Newcastle, again, I've got pages of this. Newcastle, La Palma, Spain, pilot became ill. Plane diverted back. London, first officer became incapacitated, diverted to Fargo. Captain was incapacitated, first officer was only one in control of the aircraft. Diverted to Bucharest. 30-year-old pilot had chest pain, then collapsed. Diverted as pilot collapsed shortly after takeoff, replaced by a non-Southwest pilot, meaning a customer, paying person on the plane, who was a pilot, heard the emergency and went in and had to take off. What if that guy hadn't been on the plane? Crashed. First officer was incapacitated. JFK diverted plane to pilot illness. Incapacitated pilot had chest pains. And then student pilot went into cardiac arrest behind the controls mid-flight. Instructor landed plane, pilot was dead. Then we have, my goodness, page after page. Singapore Airlines pilot died suddenly. Mind you, these are all people who are pilots or co-pilots, and they're young. 39-year-old WestJet pilot died suddenly in Calgary. British Airlines pilot had a heart attack in crew hotel in Cairo before Cairo to London flight. I want to thank Dr. William Makis, Canadian board certified physician specializing in radiology, oncology, and immunology, and at Governor's General Medical Medal, and also University of Toronto. He's author of over 100 peer-reviewed medical studies. He had all these and more. So yeah, in my whole career, not one dies. Now suddenly in just 1 month, all these deaths, and they were forced to take the vaccines. Wow. And just this is just the beginning, because 5,000 were shown to have falsified their medical records, because if they know they have myocarditis or endocarditis, they're going to end up having a heart attack or could in flight. So just want to let you know, you were told that it was all safe, nothing to worry about. Think of all the pilots now and think of what happens in your plane. We just want to share the information. Don't forget tonight, another hard-hitting program on the economy, the value of the dollar, the danger of everyone lying to us. And these are people who make money, from naked shorts, from shorts, from derivatives, credit default swaps. They make money from everything except what used to matter, manufacturing something. So it'll be an interesting discussion, 7 o'clock, PRN.live, with Professor Michael Hudson. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching and listening. Have a nice day.